Matt, what I am suggesting is that some of the problems that are emerging are a result of your behavior.
Yeah, that's not making any sense at all. Could you try speaking English like a good Chicagoan? Because it sounds like what you're saying is that some of my problems might be my fault, and I know that's not true.
Well, Pat, that is what I'm trying to say, that you need to consider that some of your problems are your fault and that you have a hand in what happens.
Yeah, that dog won't hunt. You're just not making any sense. In fact, no offense or nothing, but you're just plain wrong. Comprende?
Okay, let me try it another way. Perhaps you've heard of nature versus nurture. Nature is the genetic makeup that we have that contributes to how we behave. And nurture is how we've been raised. Oftentimes this has to do with our family of origin, in particular, our parents. We act like them, we mirror them, we respond, we think like them. And often we do this without even realizing that it's there. Helpful?
Yeah, no, this is not making any sense at all. Maybe next week we'll have a breakthrough, but today it's just not happening. I think it's time to go.
Yeah, I do. I think it's time to go, very much so, because I'm a very good nurturer. He's a very good boy, and I like taking care of him. His dad's downstairs in the car, keeping it cool for him. We're gonna take him home now, okay? And give him a good meal and hydrate him and make sure he gets a good night's sleep, because I have to get him to work very early in the morning, okay?
Thanks, Mom. She's a good mom. We'll see you later.
So there have been a couple times in my life when I have realized how much I have been shaped by my family. One of them was as a college freshman, roommate had a much closer relationship with his dad than I had with my dad. And at first, I just thought he was weird. And then later, I thought, you know, I think his relationship is better. And then as a sophomore, I took a developmental psychology class, and I was expected to write a paper on my own life. I was 19 at the time. But in the process of writing this, I came to realize how families have good aspects to them and maybe some not so good aspects to them, and how I had been shaped by my family. Then later on, we got married, and marriage tends to help you understand that you have assumptions about things you didn't even know you had assumptions about, because they have different assumptions about them. And you realize, wow, I've been shaped by my family. And then a little bit later on, there was a time when I realized that the poverty that my father had grown up in, he had a very difficult first 20-some years, that had shaped him in ways that had shaped me. And I also realized that my mom's father was mentally ill. No one had ever told me that. I just finally, the lights clicked on. I go, oh, that's what's been going on. You know, when you're little, they don't say that. I just sort of had figured out he never really worked and that had caused some hardships. And I realized, okay, so that really shaped my mom, that in turn shaped me. Now, if we do this right, at some point as an adult, you begin to process all this. And you step back and you say, so in what ways was my family good? Like, what do I have to be thankful for? And maybe in what ways was my family not so good? And maybe there are things I need to think about. Maybe there are people I need to forgive. Maybe there are things I need to sort of reimagine. And we realize families are different. Some ways my family was different were good, and some maybe not so good. And I have been shaped by that. And now as an adult, I need to sort of own that and pick the way that I'm going to go forward. And if we don't process this, and sometimes even if we try, we end up with some blind spots. And if we don't keep working on those, then we end up like Jacob. So Jacob is sort of the case study for blind spots. Last week we started and I said, I'm making seven assumptions. Number one, you want to get better. You want to grow. Number two, better looks like Jesus. He is our example. He's more than an example. He's the Son of God. He's Savior. He's Lord. But he's also our example. Better looks like Jesus. Number three, better is hard. It's hard to grow. It's hard to get better. Number four, one of the reasons why it's hard to get better is because we don't see ourselves very accurately. We have blind spots. We have biases. We have assumptions that may or may not be true. This is especially true if we have power or money. We're more likely to stay settled in our opinion because other people aren't making our life hard or they're not telling us that we're jerks. Then number six was the Bible is a place that we can go to get some coaching on this. And we turned initially to 1 Samuel 15. And I looked at Saul, the king, and said, look, Saul had to have his nose rubbed in this stuff over and over before he finally had a breakthrough and saw some things clearly. And then I said, we're going to be looking at Jacob because Jacob is a great example of the kind of life you don't want to live. I also went on and said number seven is that you're willing to work through this stuff. It's actually a bit disruptive and hard. I'm not certain all of you do want to work through this stuff. Last night after the service, a little bit today after the morning service, I ended up talking with people in tears as they're trying to sort of think through their own life and face some things they don't want to face. Again, Jacob is a great example of what happens if we don't do that. Because Jacob's life is hard in part because he keeps making it hard. He is hurt, and I'm going to argue that he is got some family of origin issues. He's got some legitimate beefs with things that happened to him. But he never quite gets past that. He never forgives. He never moves on. He remains hurt, and hurt people hurt people. And so he's got a sort of a big swath of chaos around him. And at the end of his life, he's in a bad mood and he's mad because his life has been hard. And if you've been tracking with him, you go, right, but dude, you made it harder than it had to be. So that's where we're at. And I said some other things last week, by the way. I said this idea of understanding ourselves is not new. 3,000 years ago, Socrates said that the path to wisdom is to know yourself. And John Calvin, the great Reformation theologian, said the way forward is to know God and to know ourselves. And so there's lots of people that have written about this. They've written about how hard it is to do it. They've written about how we lie to ourselves and how we have blinders on and we defense mechanisms and all that. I'm going to assume that you get that. We're going to look in Genesis 25 this morning to Jacob, if you want to turn there, we're going to start in verse 22, the passage that was read. Let me just say, in my Bible, we're on page 19, but we're really way into the Bible by this point. So Genesis 25 is towards the beginning, but we're way into the story. So the Bible is written in such a way that if you miss the first few chapters, you're out. So if it was a movie and you showed up 2 minutes late, you're never going to understand what's going on because the first 2 minutes are so critical. And in the Bible, the first three chapters, we come away with three big ideas. Number one, there's an all-powerful God who created everything everywhere, including us, and he appoints us. We're made in his image, and he appoints us as stewards over his creation. But number two, there's a rebellion, and the result of that rebellion is sin and the fall. Everything is broken, starting with us. Nothing works. We are estranged from God. We are estranged from each other. We're broken. The system doesn't work. Number three, God has promised to send someone who will fix all of this. So Genesis 3:15, we get what theologians refer to as the proto-evangelion, the first statement, the first hint of the gospel, that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. We get a hint to God's gracious act of intervening and providing a way back for us in Genesis 3:15. So all that is set up, and it shapes everything that follows. Now, chapters 4 through 11 of Genesis are also what we call universal history. Genesis 12 is, and on is going to be very different. Genesis 4 through 11 just sort of comes behind Genesis 1 through 3 and says, yes, we're really, really broken. So we've got Cain killing Abel. We've got the Tower of Babel. We've just got some examples of how dark and bad things continue to get. We realize, okay, we need this plan. We need God to send this rescuer if we got any chance of this working out. And so then in Genesis 12, he shows up to Abraham. Abraham's a shepherd wandering around the Fertile Crescent, and God says to Abraham, Abraham, if you follow me, I will bless you. I will give you land. I will give you descendants. And the promises that I made back in Genesis 3 are all going to be fulfilled through you. And Abraham enters into this covenant with God. And from Genesis 12 through basically everything through the rest of the Old Testament and most of the way through the New Testament, it's all about Abraham and his descendants. It's the Jews. And that's just going to lead us all the way through the Old Testament. It's not universal history. It's the story of a family, and then they become a tribe, and then they become a nation, and we're going to follow Abraham and his descendants. And first we get Abraham gets the land, and he doesn't have the descendants. And so Abraham and Sarah can't have children, and there's a lot of drama and theatrics around that. But then eventually Isaac is born. And there's some drama around Isaac, and then there's some challenges with Isaac, because when he gets married, he marries Rebecca, they go 20 years and don't have a child, and Isaac is praying, and that leads us to the passage that we're in today, Genesis 25, beginning in verse 22. It says, the children struggled together within her. This is Rebecca, and she said, if it is going to be this way, why go on living, right? So she went to inquire of the Lord. So finally, she is conceived. She has twins. They're not getting along in the womb. She's asking what's going on. So she goes to the Lord, and God says, verse 23, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger. Good news, Rebecca, you're having not just one child, you're having two, you're having twins. Bad news, they're not going to get along. In fact, the younger one is going to end up with the power over the older one, which in a patriarchal society is not the way this worked at all. So basically, she's going, okay, so I'm never going to have a happy Thanksgiving dinner because there's always going to be tension. And she knows this already because her husband, his half-brother, who's older than him, Ishmael, is older than Isaac. Ishmael's around, and Isaac and Ishmael don't get along. And so she's seen this play out, and she's like, oh, good grief, they're not going to get along. And we've got this one upstaging the other. Verse 24, when her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak, so they called him Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. So there's a medical condition called transfusion syndrome, in which there are twins, but there's just one placenta. And in this, one of the twins tends to get all the energy, all the food, all the nutrients, and is stronger, and the other one is weaker, so we don't know if that's what's happening here or not. But they're very different. One's outdoors, burly, man's man, and the other one prefers to live indoors in the tents, hangs out with his mom. And now we're told, verse 28, here's the pay dirt, here's the verse that shapes the sermon, that shapes everything. It says, Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebecca loved Jacob. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebecca loved Jacob. So this is pretty much all you need to read to know that they have already made reservations for the Jerry Springer show, because this is not going to play out very well. Now, Before I go on, let me go back to a point I made last week. I said Jacob is important to us in the Bible because he is part of the lineage leading to Jesus. And I want to go back and re-emphasize that point. So the Old Testament, if you read the Old Testament like as a like a book, not just a verse here or chapter here, but if you actually get the story of the Old Testament, of the Bible, then you realize sort of all roads are pointing to Jesus, right? That so God is all-powerful. He's loving and patient. That's what you're taking away from the Old Testament. People are a mess. They cannot get it right. We keep making things worse and worse and worse. This is a big bad deal because sin is actually a capital offense, but God provides a solution. He says that when guilty people can be made free if an innocent third party will die in their place. So we got a loving God, we got broken people, and we got the setup of the sacrificial system. All of this is pointing ahead to the New Testament and to Jesus. The Old Testament is pointing to Jesus. And once you get this, then you start to see, oh my goodness, there are prophets, priests, and kings in the Old Testament. That's because Jesus is the ultimate prophet. Prophets speak for God. Jesus is God. He's the ultimate prophet. Priests represent people up to God the Father. Jesus is our high priest. If Christ is your Savior, right now Jesus is your high priest in heaven interceding on your behalf. Jesus is the King of Kings. The prophets, priests, and kings of the Old Testament were pointing ahead to Jesus. And not just that, but Israel, the Jews, they sort of fail in their effort. Jesus is the new and better Israel. There's a temple, the place where God and man meet, where you go to have your sins forgiven. Jesus is the new and better temple. Jesus is the new and better Job, the one who suffers, although he's righteous. Jesus is the new and better Jonah, the one who's down for 3 days and then is back to life. Jesus is the wisdom, the fulfillment of wisdom out of the book of Proverbs. Jesus is the sacrificial system. He is the sacrifice. He's the Paschal Lamb. Everything is pointing ahead to Jesus. The Bible is about Jesus. Christianity is not this I do. It's not an ethical system. It is about God's love and grace extended to us through Jesus Christ, whom we accept. All roads lead to Jesus. Jacob's primary importance is he is part of the lineage of Jesus. God said to Abraham, I'm going to bless the whole world through your lineage, and Jacob is part of that lineage leading up to Jesus. We've got to keep the main thing the main thing. So the main thing is Jesus. Jacob is critical about Jesus. That said, there's a lot of other parts of the Bible that teach us other things. There are lots of alleys. There are lots of side stories. There are lots of teachings. And Jacob is a great illustration for us of someone who stays broken. Jacob is a great illustration of us of someone who does not process their past and remains broken and has blind spots and makes a mess out of their life. So what we get here is perhaps the first clue that Jacob has been broken by his family. What we're told, Isaac, his father, loved his brother. So his mom loved him. There's 13 words in this, and they sort of set a trajectory. Ernest Hemingway, I don't think this is actually true, but it's folklore that Ernest Hemingway won a contest with some other writers who could write the shortest novel. And they made a bet, $10, and Hemingway took a napkin and he wrote, for sale, baby shoes, never worn. And those six words sort of, you know, they grip you. So these 13 words, if you think about them, Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. I mean, it's not even just that the father is playing favorites with one son over the other. He's doing it for this really incredibly shallow reason. He liked the food that the one boy brought him. You know, he was a hunter, and he liked to eat the wild game. And so he loves the one son more than he loves the other. So this sets up the trajectory. At the start of the sermon, I said there were a few times when I had aha moments about my own family. It happened when I went to college, happened in a class, happened when I got married, other times. There's another time that I had an aha moment, and it happened after I joined the staff at this church. It's when we were getting ready to do men's fraternity. This is about 16 years ago. And we set up, this was a national program, and a number of guys in the church had heard about it, and they wanted to do it, and I sort of looked at it and said, yeah, let's do it, and so we're gearing up to get this thing ready. And men's fraternity is based on the idea that there's a lot of 30, 40, 50, 60-year-old boys out there. They're not men because, one, either no one's told them what it means to be a man, or two, they were hurt growing up and are sort of held back emotionally. And then it goes on to say there's a handful of ways that boys tend to be hurt. And one of them was the they call it the dad wound. And so their father, who cared for them, pushes too hard. Because life is hard, and so the father pushes hard and says, you've got to be hard. You know, it's a dog-eat-dog world. I'm going to keep pushing. But pushes too hard. And so the son doesn't feel the love of the father and has got issues. Or there's a mom wound, and the mom wound we saw in the video. The mom that doesn't let go, the mom that continues to sort of dote on, that doesn't let the boy grow up, right? So there's a five different wounds they talk about. So I'm reading all this stuff this summer before we're going to do it in the fall. And I start to get a little bit nervous because, anyone that's had intro to psych, to say nothing of has a PhD in clinical counseling knows, oh my goodness, like we are playing fast and loose with a lot of big, heavy ideas. And the plan seems to be rip the bandage off the wound and say, you know, go get better. We got no real training what we're doing here, but we're going to go do it. And I'm like, I don't know if this is a good idea or not. And I'm a little skittish about the whole thing. And then a couple things happen. One is, one morning while I'm reading the book that I need to read to prepare to give the talks, I'm reading about the dad wound, and I start to cry. And even I don't cry very often, even I clue in at that point, like, oh, yeah, something's going on in my heart here. This must be my issue. And I sort of knew that anyway. I just wasn't really prepared for the level at which I was going to experience this. So just to back up a step, my father passed away a few years ago and had a great fourth quarter of life. So he retired relatively young and comes to faith about that time and grows and changes and is just a very different guy that my brothers and sisters, I'm the oldest of five, we would all look at him and go, who are you and where were you when we were growing up? Because you're a very different guy. And so I had the best last years that I could hope to have with my dad, and he told me he loved me, and he told me he was proud of me, and we forgave each other, and all, you know, it was great. But at the time, that was only beginning to sort of unfold, and my experience growing up with my dad was I got the classic dad wound. So he was pushing. Whatever I did, if you had asked me what I thought of myself, I probably wouldn't have been in touch enough to know what was going on. But if I had been able to tell you, I would have said, oh, I'm trying to prove my value by excelling in anything I do. Now, the advantage that I had was my vice was a socially acceptable one, right? So what I'm hearing is, you're not loved, you're not good enough. Whatever I did, it's not good enough. So my anger at that is, I'm going to prove you wrong. I'm going to be good enough. I'm going to be better than you think. And so I would just work hard, and that, you know, I mean, some people turn to alcohol, and some people, there's a lot of different ways that if you're broken, you can sort of spin out of control. Now, there's downsides to working too hard, and I have regrets, but at the time, I didn't really fully understand all of that. And then I get this about the same time I'm working on this talk, and I'm crying around that same time. I get a phone call from my dad, who has come to faith and is at a church that's also doing men's fraternity. And I know that he's going, so I sort of have got some idea what he's working through as well. And he leaves this message. And in my adult years, my dad might have called me a half dozen times. It's just, that's not the way it worked. I would call home. If my dad answered the phone, he'd hand the phone immediately to my mom. I'd talk with my mom. My dad might get back on the phone towards the end, but it was basically to ask me questions like, you know, when I was consulting, how many billable hours did you have this week? You know, did you get that project done? What are they, you know, so it was just, I'm just sort of reporting in. That was the nature of, that was sort of the drill. So I'm 40, I'm, you know, married, I'm living, we got kids, we're living independently, but I'm still sort of checking in, right? My dad is asking these things. And I don't get that that's weird, because that's my life. So I get this phone call, and it was on the home line. We still had one back in the days when people had phones, you know, connected to the wall. So we got a home line there, and he called on that line, and he leaves a message. And he's just sort of checking in, which was a little weird, but it gets to the end, and he says, by the way, you know, hope you have a good week. By the way, I love you, and I'm proud of you. And I'm like, whoa. Where did that come from, right? And so I played it over, and 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 I'm just like mystified. Like I would play it again, and I'm like, okay, what's going on in me that I got to keep playing this thing over and over? I mean, I don't even like the guy, and I'm like, I got to hear this, and I'm like, what's happening? So I save the message, and this is back. The phone company's got the voicemail at this point, and after 30 days, they would drop messages. So I kept going back in to re-extend the message, right? And I would keep listening to it. And at one point, Sherry calls, and she says, okay, whatever message, you know, that your dad left that message for you, and it's about to be dropped again. She goes, do you need to save it, or have you dealt with it? That is the question. Have I dealt with it? Yes. And so I start to try and tell her what the message is, and I can't talk about it, right? I'm crying. I'm like, I said, I don't even understand why I've got to hear this message so much. I said, but I just keep playing it. I'll phone in and I'll listen to that message. Now, there's a whole other sermon to be preached on this topic. I mean, the power of fathers to bless their sons and mothers and daughters and mothers and sons. Right? It's complicated. I don't want to suggest it's simple, but it's worth noting. The only time we actually have the words of God the Father speaking audibly to earth during the New Testament is when God the Father says, at the time of Christ's baptism, "This is my Son whom I love. And with whom I am well pleased," right? This is my Son. I love you, and I'm proud of you, right? I mean, those are powerful words. So the first data point I've got on this men's fraternity thing is, like, it is definitely sent me for a loop. So then we announce that we're going to do it. And we say it's going to happen. It's going to be Friday morning. It's going to be 6 o'clock in the morning. And we've got this guy that comes up afterwards. He's in his mid-70s, maybe a little bit older than that. And he says to me, you're doing this men's program. He goes, 6 o'clock in the morning, are you kidding me? That is very rude and inconvenient. I can't believe you're doing that. I don't have to be up at 6 o'clock, and this is, you know, wrong, and da-da-da. So we have that little interaction. He says, well, what's it even about? And I said, well... You know, I give him a little bit about it. It's national, da, da, da. And I said, you know, it's based on the idea that a lot of men have been injured early on and haven't processed all of that. I said, for instance, you know, one of the suggestions is there's a lot of 50, 60-year-old men who get up every morning driving hard because what they ultimately want is to hear their father, who's long since passed away, say, I love you and I'm proud of you. But they didn't hear that. And so there's still this deep hunger in them. So I say this to this guy. He looks at me for about 5 seconds, and then he just breaks out crying, like convulsive sobbing. And his name is not Jack, but I said, Jack, you know, that's okay here. You know, there's a bunch of people around. I said, let's come over here. And so I sort of move him over into the corner, and I'm standing there, and he's sobbing. And after a little while, his wife comes over, and she looks at him, and then she looks at me, and she's like, what did you say to my husband? I tell her. She's like, oh boy, okay. And so we stand there for a while he's crying, and then after, I don't know, seemed like a long time, probably 30 seconds, she says, I'm just gonna take him home. Who knows how long this is gonna go on, right? So she starts to lead him away, and he stops and sort of comes back, and he's still crying, but he says, I'll be there, right? You know, I'll be there Friday morning. So, and he was there. And I've got stories of the number of men who were sort of profoundly disrupted when we talked about the dad wound. Guys, you know, after the Sunday morning or the Friday morning, coming up to me and saying, I've canceled all my meetings. I'm going right from here to O'Hare. I'm flying to see my dad. I haven't talked with him in 10 years, right? I'm gonna work this out. I want to hear him say that he loves me. I don't want to suggest that this is the only wound. I want to be clear also, when I look back, as I have processed this, and again, I had this whole sort of fourth quarter with my dad, and think through this, this is a dance. We've all got pieces of this, and I take my childhood over my dad's 100 times out of 100. I take my childhood over my mom's 100 times out of 100. I say I was born on third base. I had so many advantages. Even with all those advantages, right, there's ways that I had hurts and blind spots and hadn't figured that out. And so, look, I don't know what your story is. I don't know if you know what your story is. But we got to figure some of these things out because they are driving us. They are shaping us. Some of you have been profoundly hurt. And you're mad 50 years later. You're still mad. You're angry at everybody because of something that happened to you. And it is shaping your life. And you can't see it. But it's happening. So there are lots of different ways that this can happen. I am suggesting that you need to know your story. So I'm going to play a video. I went down to Little Rock to visit my mom. And Robert Lewis, who started Men's Fraternity, is in Little Rock. And so we got together and had lunch. And I said to him, I'm going to do this series on blind spots, and I'm going to sort of push on some of these things. And I said, I'd like to play this video clip I remember of you, in which you were talking about your sort of breakthrough. So Lewis's story is his father was an alcoholic. It sort of pulled the family into great dysfunction and poverty. And Lewis grew up in very, very angry because of this. And he sort of initially turns his anger into football success. And so he becomes a big D1 football star and defensive captain on this team. And they go to the national championship. And he says, you know, I've just got all this rage. And if you're a football linebacker, rage is a really helpful thing. Then he graduates and gets married. He's working two full-time jobs and working on three master's degrees at the same time. And he said, I couldn't see it, right? But I'm trying to desperately prove that I have value. And he says, the problem is I still have a lot of anger. And he goes, anger works really well when you're a football player. When you're a young married guy, anger is not a great lead emotion. And he says, my wife is like, would you figure some things out already? You have got to get over it. You've got to figure out what's going on because this is not working. So he says one day he storms out of the house after this altercation. He storms out of the house and he walks a few miles. He goes to this park. And for 3 hours he has this raging and then he's crying and then he's, what's wrong with me? And then he starts to go, this is about my dad. And then he's railing at his father, and then he realizes that he's going to have to forgive his father, and he goes through all that. Then he realizes that his father didn't really want to be an alcoholic either, and that his father had all these losses, and so he sort of processes a lot of this stuff. And there's a video of this, and I said, that's what I want to play. And Lewis said, no, that's actually not what you want to play. You want to play a different video. I'm going to send it to you. So this is a little clip out of a The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and I'd never seen the program. You don't have to have seen the program to appreciate this clip. So let's go ahead and run it.
Now, you gonna tell Will or not?
I'm not gonna do your dirty work for you.
Fine. I'll call him from the road.
Yeah, then why don't you do that?
Yeah, I'll do that. Daddy-o! What's up? Will, I'm glad you're here. Some business came up I gotta handle. So we're gonna have to put our trip on hold. You understand?
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. That's cool.
Just for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm, I understand. Yeah.
Maybe a little longer.
Yeah, whatever.
Look, I'll call you next week and we'll iron out the details, okay?
Yeah.
It was great seeing you, son.
You too, Lou.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Will.
You know what? Actually, this works out better for me. You know, the slimmies of summer come to class wearing next to nothing. You know what I'm
Will,
saying?
Will, it's all right to be angry.
Hey, why should I be mad? I'm saying at least he said goodbye this time. I just wish I hadn't wasted my money buying this stupid present.
I'm sorry. If there was something that I...
Hey, you know what? You ain't got to do nothing, Uncle Phil. Hey, you know, ain't like I'm still 5 years old, you know? Ain't like I'm going to be sitting up every night asking my mom, when's daddy coming home, you know? Who needs him? Hey, he wasn't there to teach me how to shoot my first basket, but I learned, didn't I? Hey, I got pretty damn good at it too, didn't I,
yeah,
Uncle Phil?
You did.
Got through my first day without him, right? Mm. I learned how to drive. I learned how to shave. I learned how to fight without him. I had 14 great birthdays without him. He never even sent me a damn card. To hell with him! I ain't need him then, and I don't need him now.
Will.
Now, you know what, Uncle Phil? I'm gonna get through college without him. I'm gonna get a great job without him. I'm gonna marry me a beautiful honey, and I'm having a whole bunch of kids. I'm gonna be a better father than he ever was. And I sure as hell don't need him for that, because ain't a damn thing he could ever teach me about how to love my kids. How come he don't want me, man?
So one of the challenges with that little clip, besides that it makes many of you cry, is that it stays in the theme of fathers and sons. And there's just lots of ways to get hurt. There's lots of ways to be wounded and to be held back and to have these blind spots that are animating us and we don't see them. So two things that I want to say as I end the sermon. One, It's likely you need to talk to somebody. Maybe you've got a great friend. Maybe this can be your small group. Maybe it's time to sign up for a spiritual check-in and talk with somebody on staff. But you sort of have to process your life. And if you haven't done it, you got to do it. So want to encourage you to take that step. And a second thing that is important to understand is I think we can only ever really fully lower our guard and look at some of these things when we have fully immersed our thinking in the gospel and we're safe. I am known by God and I am loved by God. And out of the context of that love, I can look at some of these things more objectively and see the brokenness in my own life. Let me pray. Father, I would pray for myself, as I pray for others, that you would help us see ourselves more clearly, help us drop long-standing defenses against things, help us see where wounds have been allowed to fester and cause problems, and how we're too much like Jacob, and we're causing our own hardships and headaches. So, Father, we pray to that end, and pray that we can move past these blind spots in your love and grace. Pray this in Christ's name. Amen.